Last time we began Genesis chapter 6, and I believe we read up through verse 8, and I made some comments. I did not treat it as thoroughly as I would like to, and yet I'm going to resist the temptation to go back into that same material, just because once I do, that material can detain me forever. We saw that something happened. The sons of God, attracted to the physical beauty, it actually says, of someone called the daughters of men, took wives of as many as they chose, or all whom they chose, and they, and this somehow contributed to the condition that prevailed before the flood, a condition that was so horrendous that God said that he's going to have to wipe everything out here. And when we closed last time, I mentioned there are really two theories about who the sons of God are. One, that they are angels who fell, and that they went after human women. And this is a very widely held view. The rabbis, prior to the time of Christ, held this view about it. And there are Christians, even from the days of the church fathers, who have held this view also, that we're looking here at angels who fell. We do know from the New Testament that there are angels who fell. However, the New Testament does not necessarily identify the fall of those angels with this story. We don't know whether this is the account to which the New Testament authors allude. We simply know that in 2 Peter chapter 2 and in the book of Jude, we are told that the angels who did not keep to their first estate, God has reserved in chains under darkness, awaiting the judgment of the great day. And so that simply tells us that there are angels who are no longer angels, no longer at least good angels. They are under judgment. They have rebelled. And some have felt that Genesis chapter 6 provides the backdrop for that event. After all, we must assume that Peter and Jude, who both mentioned the fall of angels, had some biblical basis for believing what they did. Believe about this, and we don't read anywhere in the Bible of angels falling. That is, we don't read the event, we don't read a story of it in the Old Testament. Unless, of course, this is that story, and some have felt that this is it. Widely held view, and some say, well, that would certainly explain why the Nephilim were in the earth in those days. In verse 4, there were Nephilim on the earth in those days. And although no one knows exactly what Nephilim means, it's obviously a plural word because it ends with im. But what a Nephil is, no one really knows for sure. As I said in the last few moments of our class last time, the word only occurs one other time in all known Hebrew literature, and that is in Numbers 13:33, where the Nephilim were also declared to have been seen by the spies who went into Canaan, and they saw there the Nephilim. And now, it does say in that latter place that the Nephilim were so intimidating that the spies felt as though they were like grasshoppers by comparison to the Nephilim, suggesting, of course, great size. Whatever the Nephilim were very large and very intimidating, apparently. Based on this information and having no other information etymologically for the word Nephilim or lexical information, the scholars generally feel that the Nephilim must have been giants of some sort since they were big. Whether they were giant humans or giant animals or giant something else, you know, giant Sitka spruce trees or whatever, you know, I mean, whatever they are. Of course, no one's very intimidated by spruce trees. But we're not told what they are. The only thing we can deduce is that they were large. Therefore, we are left with the possibility that the Nephilim were large humans. We know there were such things. We know there were Anakim, which were a race of giant humans. There were the sons of the giant, of whom Goliath was one of five sons of a giant, the Bible indicates. And the sons were all giants too, including Goliath. However, when we talk about giants in the Bible, we're not talking about giants in the Jack and the Beanstalk type sort, you know, the tower above skyscrapers, but we're talking about giants who are more like basketball players today, you know, somewhat approaching 10 feet tall or something. That's very large, even by today's standards. But if indeed the Nephilim were giant humans, then it does raise the possibility that, well, it raises the necessity of explaining why there were Nephilim there. I mean, presumably, there might not have been afterwards, if they were before the flood. Why is this mentioned? There were Nephilim in the earth in those days. Were these the products of the marriages of the sons of God to the daughters of men? If they were, and if they were extraordinary large humans, it is suggested that this confirms that the marriage of the sons of God to the daughters of men was a marriage of a superhuman sort, that the sons of God were not human beings, they must have been angels, because look, their marriages resulted in exceptionally large, unusually, certainly worth mentioning in terms of their unusual size, offspring. And when someone suggests the other possibility, well, the sons of God may not have been angels, they may have just been ordinary people who were godly, which is the other possibility. The objection is raised, well, then why would the Nephilim have been born to them? And I would point out that if you'd read verse 4, it does not say that the Nephilim were the products of those marriages. In fact, it may imply that the Nephilim were there before and after the marriages, because it says there were Nephilim on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them. Sounds like it's saying there were Nephilim then and after those marriages, before and after. The wording is ambiguous, we can't be sure. But I will say this, if the presence of Nephilim requires marriages between angels and humans to produce, then we have to raise another problem, and that is, why were the Nephilim in the Promised Land after the flood, in the days of the spies who saw them there? These Nephilim, whatever they were, we presume if they were human, they were wiped out in the flood, unless there were some of them in Noah's family, because only Noah's family made it through the flood. Therefore, if we're talking about giant humans here, then they would have been wiped out in the flood. And long after the flood, Nephilim are seen in the land of Canaan again. Now, all I'm saying about this is that if it takes supernatural marriages, supernatural sexual unions to produce whatever the Nephilim were, and that's where they came from in Genesis 6, then we must assume that such supernatural unions must have occurred also later, though unrecorded, to produce the Nephilim after the flood, who were seen in the land of Canaan. This I do not think to be likely. I can't rule it out entirely, but I just don't. It doesn't strike me as a likely scenario. If the Nephilim, on the other hand, were animals of some sort, some have even suggested maybe the dinosaurs, then there would be an explanation of how they happened to exist after the flood as well, because all the animals that existed, that would have to include dinosaurs if they were around at the time, went on the flood. They were represented on the ark, and they passed through the flood, and therefore many of them existed for a long time after the flood. Dinosaurs, if they would be among those that were on the ark, have since, of course, seemingly perished and become extinct. I say seemingly because you still hear reports about large creatures in remote areas that have been undiscovered. And we do know that there was a creature pulled up in 1977 by a ship off the coast of Japan, and they photographed it. It was dead, but recently. It had not decomposed yet, and it looked every bit like a plesiosaur, a seagoing dinosaur about 30 feet long. Because it was beginning to rot and stink and spoil the catch of fish on the ship, after they photographed it and took a sample of its flesh for analysis, they threw it back overboard. Got in big trouble for that, because once the flesh was analyzed as that of a reptile, and the photograph resembled very much a dinosaur, their superiors kind of wished they had held on to it a little bit. But a recently dead animal pulled out of the sea that may have been a dinosaur. And, of course, there have been reports. None of them have been verified beyond the shadow of a doubt, of people seeing creatures in some of the most remote and unexplored jungle areas, especially of Africa, that may have been dinosaurs. But we don't. I'm not here to promote the notion that there are still dinosaurs. All I can say is we don't know for sure that there aren't. There are parts of the world that have not yet been explored, and we know the earth was once covered with dinosaurs. We don't know exactly what made them all die off, or most of them, or whatever, the vast majority. They don't seem to be here anymore. But that does not mean that they weren't here prior to the flood, And it does not mean that some specimens did not make it through the flood on the ark. I realize people will often say, well, how in the world could Noah fit dinosaurs on the ark? They're huge creatures. Well, I would remind you that Noah was not commanded to take adult specimens, necessarily. That the largest dinosaur, a Brachiosaurus, when it hatches from an egg, the eggs have been found. They're big eggs, bigger than any eggs of any creatures alive today. But a hatchling dinosaur, even of the largest species, wouldn't be any bigger than a sheep. Probably not much bigger than a newborn sheep. And so if Noah was not required to take adult specimens, there's no reason why he couldn't have taken samples of dinosaurs as well as other animals if they were not yet extinct. I don't know. No one knows for sure whether the dinosaurs became extinct before the flood or after. But there's no proof anywhere that dinosaurs died off before the flood. I know the conventional wisdom of the evolutionists is that dinosaurs died out in the Cretaceous era 70 million years ago, and that man didn't evolve until 67 million years later. And therefore, no man would have ever seen a dinosaur. They would never cross paths. The last dinosaur was gone 67 million years before the first man appeared. And therefore, the suggestion that dinosaurs could have been around alongside man and even had been around to be represented on the ark as part of the living world that was preserved sounds ridiculous to the conventional scientific theory. But I would just remind you that scientists, when they say dinosaurs died out 70 million years ago, simply have no proof of that whatsoever. They have no proof that the rocks in which the dinosaur bones are found are indeed as ancient as they suggest. And there are some very questionable, or let's say so there are some evidences that call into question these theories, including the fact that virtually all cultures, ancient cultures, have legends about giant reptilian dragons, for example. There is also the fact that there are cave drawings in the Philippines from ancient peoples who left those caves 1,500 years ago, long before dinosaur bones have been found in modern times, and there are cave drawings of what appear to be brontosaurus drawn by people who had never found the skeletons. You know, dinosaur skeletons weren't found until about 100 years ago. And so these people presumably may have seen the animals they were drawing, or else they had vivid imaginations that happened to correspond with later discovered realities. And, of course, there's the much-disputed footprints in the Pelixi River in Texas, which you may have heard of. They're much-disputed because some scientists are quite convinced they're fakes. Others are quite convinced that many of them are genuine. And what they have found, of course, is what appear to be three-toed dinosaur footprints, a trail of footprints in a riverbed, fossilized, and in the same strata, a trail of human footprints, which makes it either appear that the man was following the dinosaur or the dinosaur was following the man, but roughly at the same time. And as I say, there are many who believe those are fakes, and they may well be. However, there has been some interesting evidence presented I have heard and seen that suggests the possibility of them being genuine. All I can say is there is absolutely no proof whatsoever that dinosaurs died out before man arrived. And it would certainly not agree with the Bible to say they did, because the Bible suggests that all living creatures, all land animals, were created the same day as man. And beyond question, dinosaurs were animals. It's amazing to me how many Christians get perplexed about the dinosaur problem. I'm continually asked this. What about the dinosaurs? How do you fit that in the Bible? I say, what's the problem? Are dinosaurs animals? Yes. Does the Bible say anything about animals? Yes. Does the Bible say when animals were made? Yes. What's the problem then? Dinosaurs are animals. There were sea-going animals and flying animals created on the fifth day and terrestrial animals on the sixth day. Some dinosaurs lived in the sea, some flew in the air, and some lived on land. Just like some modern species, as we might call them, live in the sea and live in the air and live on land. What's the problem? I mean, it's in the mind of the modern person, dinosaurs are in a separate class than animals in general, so that when we read of the creation of animals, it never occurs to them. Dinosaurs, too, are animals. They were created at the same time other animals were. And this is, of course, because of our educational brainwashing that suggests that dinosaurs belong not to the present animal world. They're part of a ancient time, long, long before any of the modern species ever came to exist, that is just plain conjecture. And it certainly doesn't agree with the Bible. It doesn't even agree with all the facts. So I am at least open to the possibility that dinosaurs may have still been around in the days of Noah. Job appears to mention dinosaurs. We can't be sure that it's dinosaurs he mentions, but in the 40th chapter of Job, he describes some creatures that one of them is called Behemoth in Job. No one knows what Behemoth was or is. And the other is called Leviathan. And Behemoth is actually described in Job chapter 40. And Leviathan is described in Job chapter 41. And these creatures seem to be scaly, huge creatures, terrifying to look upon. Scales so hard that they break spears against them. Rows of teeth around the mouth that are terrifying to look at when they open their mouth. Creatures so huge they eat all the foliage on a hillside, one of them does, and drinks up a river, so to speak, hyperbole no doubt. But the fact is, there is the description of creatures that Job and his contemporaries were acquainted with. Now, Job is thought perhaps to have been one of the oldest books of the Bible, even written before Moses' time. And the book of Job presupposes an awareness of these animals that are described. What they were, no one knows for sure, but they certainly could have been dinosaurs. So I am suggesting the possibility, not the likelihood necessarily, or the unlikelihood, just the possibility that Behemoth and Leviathan mentioned in Job may have been dinosaurs, and if Job knew of dinosaurs, the people of Noah's day might have known of dinosaurs. To say there were Nephilim, giant somethings in the earth in those days, and also afterward, and by the way, also after the flood in the land of Canaan, there were some, suggests that whatever the Nephilim were must have survived the flood. You find them before and after. And yet, if they were human giants, how could they survive the flood? All humans except Noah's family were killed, but all animals were preserved. So anyway, I don't really know. No one knows. I don't pretend to know what no one can know. But it does seem very possible that some dinosaurs, some species may have still been in the earth in the days of flood. Some of them may have been taken on the ark. And some of them may have still been around even in the days when Moses sent the spies into Canaan. And I dare say, while warriors might indeed be intimidated by giant men, after all, the armies of Israel were intimidated by Goliath, yet it would be even more terrifying to say, we're going in to conquer a land that's got Tyrannosaurus Rex running loose. And, I mean, I don't know. That would be even scarier. But we'll just have to wait until we go to heaven to find out what the real answer to that is. Anyway, God saw the earth was really bad. Things had gotten really bad. Earth was full of violence, wickedness continually, so God determined that he was going to give man 120 years more before judgment fell. It was apparently at this point, 120 years before the flood, that God first communicated to Noah his intention. Now we read in verse 9, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. And Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it to a cubit above, from above, and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. And behold, I myself am bringing the flood of waters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. And everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you And you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing, of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark, to keep them alive with you, and they shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, of animals after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to you, to keep them alive. And you shall take for yourselves all food, or take for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them. Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him, so he did. Now the story of the flood occupies the next two chapters, 7 and 8. I hope to get through both of them in this session. I hope that we might just cover the whole story of the flood in one session. That's going to require that I do a bit of summarizing. Yes? We'll get to that. We'll get to that. Fishes, of course, do not have to be kept alive on the ark because they are already able to live in the environment that everyone else was having to escape. One of the third deck of the ark was an aquarium. No, actually, it's clear that it was not necessary to bring every kind of animal on the ark. Only those, as it is said, in whose nostrils is the breath of life. Fish don't have nostrils, but even among those that are air-breathing creatures, there are some that do that live in the sea. I mean, we've got the whales and the dolphins and so forth. Although they breathe air, they would stand as exceptions, notable exceptions to the general rule that air-breathing creatures would have to be brought aboard. Even aquatic reptiles like crocodiles and alligators and sea snakes and sea turtles and things like that, they're reptiles, they're not fish, but they don't live on land anyway. Of course, crocodiles and sea turtles do come ashore, but there are marine crocodiles that actually live in the ocean, cross the ocean from continent to continent. I mean, just almost like sea creatures do. It's probable that these creatures didn't have to be brought on the ark either. Anything that could survive without being on the boat could probably be left off. But there were only certain animals that definitely would die in a flood if they were not preserved, and we can probably assume safely that when he says of every creature, he means of every creature that would need to come on the boat, not necessarily every creature, including those that don't need to. You can imagine him dragging a reluctant dolphin ashore, up into the boat. No, I don't want to go. You have to. I have to get every creature in here. I'm sure that wouldn't be necessary. Pardon? In all likelihood, yeah. In all likelihood, the aquatic dinosaurs, if they were indeed still around, would be not have to come aboard. Okay, let me talk about this a little bit. It says that God told Noah to build an ark. And when we think of the ark, we think of a boat-shaped kind of a thing, because we're all acquainted with children's picture books of Noah's ark. And Noah's ark is drawn up to look like a boat, with a stern and a hull and everything like a regular boat, kind of rounded sides and so forth. Actually, though, there is a fairly detailed description of how the ark was to be made. It doesn't give those particular details of whether it was boat-shaped or not. And the word ark itself does not mean boat. The word ark in the Hebrew simply means a box or a chest. At another time, later on, we read of Moses' mother putting him, when he was a baby, in an ark. Among the bulrushes, she actually made a basket kind of a floating thing to put her baby in, to hide her baby from the decree of the Pharaoh, who was going to kill all the infant males. And the word that is used there is also ark. Same thing, a box or a chest. The purpose of the ark was not to navigate or to sail. It was simply to float. There was nowhere to go to anyway. I mean, once the mountains were covered, you're not sailing anywhere. Everywhere is all the same as where you are. It's just everything's water. There's no place to go. You don't have to navigate anywhere. You don't need to be seaworthy You just need to be able to float like a cork. You just got to make sure you don't submerge. And therefore, it's very possible that the ark wasn't boat-like at all, but it was just like a big old box, because that's what the word ark means. That's not a very important fact to be aware of, but it is nonetheless some point of clarification, because we often talk about Noah's boat, Noah's big boat. Well, it might have been a boat, but it might have just been a big box. It was watertight. The size of it is given in verse 15. 300 cubits by 50 cubits by 30 cubits. Now, this is the first time we encounter cubits in the Old Testament, but we will encounter them again when the tabernacle and other things whose size are measured are discussed. Might as well get acquainted with a cubit right now. A cubit is approximately 18 inches. Cubit was a measurement in the days before they had exact measures. You know, they didn't have to measure everything exactly in ancient times like we do with all our high-tech stuff. We have to have exact, down to the micrometers and so forth. In those days, you know, it was sort of a good enough philosophy of construction. And a cubit was considered to be the distance between the average man's tip of his forefinger, I should say of his middle finger, to his elbow when his hand is extended and his wrist straight. So the distance from the longest finger's end to the elbow was a cubit. Obviously not all men had the same length of arm, and a cubit would therefore not be a universal standard that everyone would follow, at least not initially. Noah just had to measure a cubit by his own arm. There might have been a bigger man who, if he had been given the task of building the ark, would have built a bigger ark, because there'd be more, a cubit would be larger. Same number of cubits, but a bigger cubit. That would not be disastrous. It later was more standardized in later history that a cubit was considered to be approximately 18 inches, because that was considered to be the average length of the average man. So we will just consider, for the sake of getting an idea of the size of the ark, that a cubit's approximately a foot and a half, 18 inches. That makes it very easy to kind of picture the size of the ark. 300 cubits, its length is 450 feet. That's like a football field and a half. That's like the length of a football field and another half of a football field added to that. You can picture that. It's big. Big for a boat, if that's what it is. Big for a box, too, for that matter. Big for anything. Now, the width of it was 50 cubits, which would be 75 feet. Which means that the width was 1/6 the length. The length was 6 times the width. Now, that's an interesting fact in view of the fact that that is the same ratio that modern seagoing vessels use. The average freighter or whatever follows a ratio very similar, a length approximately 6 times the width. Which means that, and by the way, modern shipbuilding is not done based on the Bible. I know some modern shipbuilders just say, well, what did God say Noah should build the ark like? Let's build our ships like that. Obviously, they don't consult the Bible. They do it on the basis of sound engineering principles. But the fact that God told Noah to do this at a time before any sound engineering principles were known about shipbuilding shows that there may be some wisdom beyond Noah's own that inspired his ship size, his box size, or whatever. This is interesting in view of the fact that other legends of the flood, and almost all ancient civilizations have a legend of the flood, and in almost all of them there was a boat of some kind or a box of some kind that floated a few survivors. Like the Babylonian myths and the Sumerian myths about the flood, they always make the ark out to be something really strange shape, like a cube 1,500 feet, 1,500 feet this way, that way, and up, too. You know, imagine how that would roll around on the choppy seas. That'd be quite a wild ride inside there, It's this little cube, be like throwing a dice across the water. And there are others that, that make the ark like 5,000 feet long and so forth. I mean, it's interesting that while virtually all ancient cultures have legends that remain about the flood and about a boat that's preserved a few survivors, Yet many of them are so unrealistic in terms of the details of the description of the ark, whereas the ark given here, the dimensions are just about the size of a modern ocean liner, about the same size and same dimensions, 6 times as long as it is wide, and it was, as far as its height or its vertical dimension, it was 30 cubits, which is 45 feet. Now, later on, we're going to read that the water covered the mountaintops to the distance of 15 cubits. That'd be 22 and a half feet. Now, I don't know if Noah got out there and measured, with a measuring tape how far down the mountaintops were to get that figure, or if he just deduced that from the fact that the ark rested about half submerged, and therefore about 22 and a half feet of it would be above water, about 22 and a half feet below water, and since they didn't touch any mountaintops, figured the mountains must be covered that much, at least that much. In any case, the dimensions of the ark, although a very huge structure, are quite realistic and quite sensible compared to many of the other rival legends about the flood. Now, there's mention of a window. In verse 16, you shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it from a cubit from above. Now, this would not be a glass window, since they almost certainly didn't have access to glass back then. Even in much more modern times, glass was not available. In all likelihood, the window is simply a place for air to go through, and it is generally thought that there was a roof with eaves. And it doesn't say so, but this is the best way to conceive it, that there was a roof over the ark, and that it had eaves that stuck out beyond the walls of the ark, and under that there was about a 18 inches, a cubit, of airspace, so that the eaves would prevent water from coming in, but the airspace would allow air to come in. After all, you got all those stinky creatures in there, going to have some ventilation. Even if you could stand the smell, they have to breathe something. And the ark is otherwise sealed up with pitch. It's airtight and watertight. So there is a place around the top, apparently, it's called a window, apparently 18 inches tall, to allow air in, but not water. In all likelihood, to prevent water from coming in, there must have been maybe lengthy eaves that came down and fully covered that. What else do we see here? The ark was 3 stories, and it had 1 door in the side, and the whole structure was to be covered with pitch inside and out. Now, one thing that's really kind of interesting about this, about the pitch, is that the word that is translated here as pitch in verse 14 is the same word in the Hebrew that is later used when translated atonement. You will find in the book of Leviticus and other Old Testament books that use the word atonement, that the same word is used that is used here for pitch. It literally means a covering. We don't know that it was actually pitch. The Hebrew word just means a covering. But so does atonement mean a covering. So literally, you could render this, if you're going to always render that word the same, you should cover it inside out with a covering, and that covering being the same word for atonement. Now, the only reason I bring that up is, of course, it probably was pitch or tar or something that he covered it with. It's clear that he's saying you need to seal up the seams so water doesn't leak in. But when we see the ark as a type of Christ and the salvation of Noah's family in the ark through the flood is a type of the salvation of believers in Christ through the judgment of God, it is the atonement that stands between them and the judgment of God. Just as the pitch prevented the waters of judgment from coming in and kept them dry and untouched by the judgment, so the atonement of Christ, the blood of Christ, covers and atones and keeps us separated from the judgment of God, stands between us and judgment. And that is, I think, an interesting point. Now, it's often been asked, well, how could Noah really take 2 of every creature on the boat? Granted, it's a large boat, but is it really large enough that every creature could come aboard? Now, there are millions of species of creatures. And it does, at first glance, seem like there's just far too many. No boat that you could even imagine could contain them all. Imagine, for instance, the San Diego Zoo, which is much larger than the ark was, It doesn't even have samples of every animal in the world. It was for a long time the largest zoo in the world. I think another one has overtaken it now. But it takes days to walk through the thing just to see them. And to suggest that you could make a box or a boat that could contain all these creatures, very hard to imagine. But, as I said earlier, there are many creatures that would not have to be on the ark. There are millions, probably, of species of fish and other aquatic animals that are not fish but live in the sea full time or live in water. Dugongs and dolphins and whales and so forth are not fish, but they live in the water all the time. There are seals and walruses and so forth that are not fully aquatic, but they can live in the sea. They only have to come on land sometimes, but they can spend a lot of their time in the sea, even way far out at sea. It's possible that with the debris that would be floating around, that such animals could occasionally get up out of the water as they needed to, but they could also dive and feed themselves from the sea just like they would at ordinary times. There are therefore mammals as well as fish, and there are reptiles and amphibians that can all live in the sea and would not have to be brought aboard. That radically reduces the number of animals that have to be brought aboard. Then you have to consider that of the millions of species of animals, several million species are insects and arachnids, very small, don't take a lot of space. And therefore, millions of species of very, very tiny creatures could certainly be accommodated in a relatively small space. When it comes to the regular animals, regular land animals that in no way could survive in the water, it has been estimated, and by the way, there's been a lot of study done on this. There's a very thick book called The Genesis Flood where a couple of scientists have considered this from virtually every angle. They have considered that the ark would have to contain approximately, of land animals, 35,000 specimens. Because so many animals can live, birds could perch on the outside, aquatic creatures could swim, wouldn't have to be brought aboard. A lot of the creatures, like insects, are so small that they could be contained in a very small space. As far as animals, that sizable animals that would take up considerable room, the ark had to have room for about 35,000 specimens, according to the calculations of some who've done far more work on this than anyone else I know. Now, was the ark big enough to accommodate 35,000 specimens plus food for all of them for the whole period of time? That's a good question. It has been calculated that the ark had almost 1.5 million cubic feet, had three decks, which of course gave it lots of floor space, and it has been claimed that the ark had the same capacity for holding animals as would 522 railroad stock cars. 522 railroad stock cars. Now, though some animals are very large, some are very small. You've got elephants and hippos and rhinos, and maybe even in those days, dinosaurs to accommodate. Although, as I say, young specimens in each case could have been brought on, which reduces the amount of space they'd occupy and the amount of food they'd eat. But you also have many, many tiny creatures, mice and other kinds of rodents and so forth. And therefore, to take an average of all the land animals that have to be accommodated, it has been calculated that the average size comes out to about the size of a sheep. And that's not so awfully huge. It means that the ark would have to have room for about 35,000 sheep. Not all the animals were sheep, but some were larger and many were smaller. But 35,000 specimens had to be there. The average size of the specimens were that of a sheep. So the ark needs to accommodate or be capable of accommodating 35,000 sheep. As I said, its capacity was equivalent to 522 railroad stock cars. Each railroad stock car can carry 240 sheep. What this means is that the ark could have accommodated 125,000 sheep. It was capable of accommodating 125,000 sheep. Yet its capacity only had to be large enough to accommodate 35,000 sheep. Now, if the estimate of how many animals there needed to be accommodated is perhaps too low, you can see there's a lot of room to increase it there. The ark could actually accommodate 125 specimens, but as far as is calculated, only needs to accommodate 35,000. That means 90,000 sheep more could have fit on it besides what needed to. And if you want to increase the number of animals somehow that had to be on the ark, there's plenty of room for extras. In fact, there's a lot of room for food, too. Now, on the other hand, food, no one knows how much food would be needed. Noah was supposed to take food on the ark to be food for the animals and for himself, but an elephant or a hippo or a dinosaur can eat an awful lot of food in a short time. And it's really hard to know whether you could accommodate these creatures for a year, which is how long they were on the ark, enough food for them in the remaining space that was there on the ark. And the reason we can't know for sure is we don't know whether those animals were eating the whole time. The fact that they were to take this stuff on for food might mean, partially, that in the new world, when the flood is over, you're going to have to plant this and grow food for yourselves. You need to preserve not only animals through the flood, but plants through the flood that would not survive well, and which you're going to need to eat later. Whether these animals ate on the ark during the year they were there or not is not known for sure. We know that many animals, including some very large ones like bears, hibernate. Usually not for a whole year, but they can hibernate for a very long time. In fact, many scientists say that virtually all species of animals are probably capable of hibernation. Not all of them generally do, but very many kinds of animals do hibernate. And it's probable that if necessity were laid upon them, that most species could hibernate. Now, I'm not saying this is what happened, but I'm saying this presents a scenario that is entirely plausible. It's possible that God, once bringing the animals on the ark, caused them to hibernate for the majority of the time of the flood. Yes?
What about animals that were native to Noah's area?
Well, the animals had. Well, we don't know whether there were animals that weren't native to Noah's area. Today animals are distributed over the continents in a certain way. We don't know what the animal distribution was like before the flood. In fact, we don't even know if there were separate continents yet. It's entirely possible that the drifting of the continents and the separation of the continents that we take for granted has occurred since the time of the flood. Now, some would say, but it's going so slowly. How could it possibly have gone? How could the oceans have gotten so large in that time? It's only been, 3,500 years or more like 4,000 years ago. Actually, even a little more than that, probably 4,500 years ago. How could the continents have drifted so far? Well, that's a good question. How fast were they drifting initially? No one knows. But it's not inconceivable that after the flood, that the damage done to the Earth's crust by the breaking up of subterranean waters and so forth set in motion the tectonic plates in a motion that God himself directed or made to happen, so that the continents may have drifted rather rapidly after the flood. And the slow rate that they're doing it now might reflect just the gradual slowing down. Just now, 4,000 years later, it's just slowing down, to the point that it's so slow. All I'm saying is there are plausible suggestions that would accommodate everything necessary to be accommodated by the theory of the flood. We don't know everything we would like to know, and we can't know everything we'd like to know. But there are possibilities that make it no problem. It's possible that before the flood there was only one continent, that all animals shared equal distribution, that every species of animal was local, as well as everywhere else on the earth. They're just distributed fairly evenly over the earth. The earth only had one climate at that time in all likelihood. There's no reason to believe there were polar zones. Now you might say, well, but how did polar bears live in a tropical climate? How did penguins that now live in Antarctica live in a polar tropical climate? I don't know. Maybe they didn't. Maybe there weren't polar bears then. Maybe polar bears are a mutation of other species of bears that were back then. Who knows? We don't know. But we do know this. We know for a fact that since the time of the flood, there has been tremendous adaptation of some species, including human-directed adaptation. For instance, I gave you an example of dogs. You've got dogs that can live in the Arctic, and you've got dogs that would die if they left their mobile home. I mean, there are certainly a wide variety of species of dogs that have adapted or been adapted by man to live in all kinds of environments. And to suggest that that hasn't happened with other species of animals would be naive in the extreme. I mean, as climates changed after the flood, so different species of animals could easily have undergone adaptation, as dogs do and as other creatures do. I mean, even your pet dog's going to get a winter coat in the wintertime. I mean, it's interesting how God has created animals with the ability to adapt to environment and to survive, not infinitely. So I'm of the opinion that the ark was more than adequate. It's possible even that the majority of the animals hibernated most of the time, so that feeding them was not an issue. He might have had to feed them initially, and then they went into hibernation. But there's really no way of knowing for sure. We then come to chapter 7. And I'd like to read, first of all, the first 16 verses and then make comment. Then the Lord said to Noah, "Come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. You shall take with you 7 each of every clean animal, a male and his female, 2 each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female. Also 7 each of birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth. For after 7 more days I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made." And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was on the earth. So Noah and his sons, his wife and his sons' wives, went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Of clean beasts, of beasts that are unclean, of birds, and of everything that creeps on the earth, 2 by 2 they went into the ark to Noah, male and female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were on the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the 2nd month, the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day Noah and Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and 3 wives of his sons with them entered the ark. They and every beast after its kind, all cattle after their kind, every creeping thing that creeps on the earth after its kind, and every bird after every sort, and they went into the ark to Noah, 2 by 2, of all flesh in which is the breath of life. So those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. Now, apparently 7 days before the flood actually started, God told Noah, get in the ark with your family. All the animals apparently came during that 7 days. It doesn't mean that Noah shut himself in the ark, you know, like waiting for the rain to come. God just told him to move in. So they probably used the finished ark as sort of a house, and they operated from that as a home, probably went in and out during that 7 days, very possibly in order to finish the task of bringing the animals in. Now, of course, people always ask, you know, how did Noah go out and collect all those animals? They always try to picture, people who are skeptics always try to picture, you know, Noah out there trying to chase down a cheetah or something, you know, on a bicycle or something. How's he going to catch up with that cheetah and get it to come? Well, there's really not a serious problem there. In chapter 6 and verse 20, it says specifically, of the birds after their kind, of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, 2 of every kind will come to you. He didn't have to go to them. He didn't have time to be a boat builder and a naturalist trapper, hunter. You know, the animals came to him. And it specifically says that here in chapter 7, verse 15 also. And they went into the ark to Noah. God brought them there. And that's not fantastic or hard to understand. Animals migrate even now. When weather is going to be bad, and even before meteorologists can predict it, instinctively animals often know it's time to move to a place of safety. Certain animals make regular cycles, of course, yearly as the seasons change, but they start making the transition before the weather is visibly changed. It's instinctive. God puts it in them. Animals often can sense danger even before people know it's coming. And they often instinctively will go to a place that's going to be safer. God could easily amplify or extrapolate on that ordinary instinct of animals to the point where all the animals, at least the ones he wanted to be there, instinctively knew danger was coming and came to the ark. There are many things we do not understand about animal instincts. They are mysterious to us. We don't understand how animals navigate, how sea turtles navigate thousands of miles to lay their eggs in the same place that they were born at 30 years earlier, though they haven't been there in the meantime. How butterflies, which are hatched in New England, fly down to a certain grove of trees in Mexico where their parents were born and lay their eggs and die there. No one knows how this happens. It's one of those great mysteries God has dangled out there like a carrot on a stick before the inquisitive scientist to say, you don't know everything yet, and you probably never will. And certainly with those kind of mysteries around us every day, it's not hard to figure out how God could instinctively bring the animals to the ark. I have never had a problem with that. God is capable of doing that, and the Bible indicates that that's what he did. There is one point in this passage that some have thought maybe is a contradiction. Because in verse 2 it says, you shall take seven each of every clean animal and two each of unclean animals. And yet it says in verse 8 and verse 9, of clean beasts, of beasts that are unclean, of birds and everything that creeps, two by two they went into the ark to Noah. Now, what is suggested by the critic here is that verses 8 and 9 say that clean beasts and unclean beasts came in two by two. But in verse 2, it suggests that the clean beasts actually were numbered more than two each. But there's not really a problem here either. Skeptics always look for problems where they don't need to find them in the Bible. The Bible makes it plain and indisputable. There were seven, either individuals or seven pairs of each clean animal. It is not entirely clear whether it's seven individuals or seven pairs. If it is seven pairs, there's no problem with them going two by two. 14 animals of a species can still walk in two columns. They can go in two by two, even if there's 14 of them. On the other hand, if there's seven of them, that's an odd number. But to say they went in two by two could just be general. The animals tended to go in with their mates. They tended to go in by pairs. But if there was an odd animal there, some clean animal, and he was number seven, and he happened to go in alone, that would not in any way make it inappropriate to describe the general embarking of the animals as doing it in two by two. But I suspect it was seven pairs of each. I don't think that God necessarily had an odd animal there of each clean species that had no mate. It's probable that we have seven pairs, and there's no problem with them going in two by two. Now, what was a clean animal? At a later time, in the law of Moses, a clean animal was one of those that Jews could eat, and an unclean animal was one that they couldn't eat. Yet, we know that before the flood, people were not supposed to eat animals anyway. It wasn't until after the flood that God gave permission to eat animals. Prior to that, we seem to be told that everyone was vegetarian or herbivorous. That being so, it raises the question, what is meant by a clean animal? Well, even before people ate animals, they sacrificed animals. But not every animal was a clean animal for sacrifice. Under the law of the Jews later on, of course, after Noah's day by a good bit, the same animals that were clean to eat were the animals that were clean to sacrifice. An animal that was unclean in terms of eating was also unclean in terms of sacrifice. It is fair assumption that even before any people were eating animals, they were already sacrificing animals, and there was already a distinction between clean and unclean with reference to sacrificial animals. In fact, we know that Abel offered a lamb, and it's probable that godly people did that as a regular habit. We also know this. There seems to be confirmation of this. In chapter 8 of Genesis, in verse 20, Because when the flood was over, it says Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So that confirms that clean here seems to be relevant to that which is capable of being sacrificed. He didn't offer any unclean animals. Now, why did God have seven pairs instead of one pair of the clean animals? For that very purpose, no doubt. So that they could be sacrificed. We don't know at what intervals Noah was to offer them or what quantities, but it's clear that he took a larger number because he was supposed to sacrifice some of them. And there had to be enough to perpetuate the species as well as being extras for sacrifice, so God told him to bring them. So about a week before the rain starts, the family moves into the ark, and then God shuts them in. Now, it says that Noah was 600 years old in verse 11, and it appears that the rain and the water began to come on the 17th day of the second month of Noah's 600th year. Now, that may seem like a trivial matter, not worth paying much attention to, but we're going to see that several different points during the flood narrative, we will have dates given. And we can actually follow the progress of the flood, and we can see exactly how long it lasts by comparison of these dates. Now, it says in the end of verse 11, the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were open. Obviously, figure of speech by the windows of heaven, but if there was this vapor canopy surrounding the atmosphere, as some think, it would apparently mean that all this vapor was condensed and fell like rain on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. The waters of the fountains of the great deep would apparently either mean that volcanic or other seismic activity caused tsunamis or tidal waves to come up from the depths of the ocean and to overflow the earth, or possibly even that fissures in the earth's crust release subterranean waters. We know there's a great deal of subterranean water under the earth. I mean, that's why we dig wells to get water, because there's water down there. And that this huge and unmeasurable water supply was poured out above ground. The fissures in the earth's crust caused water to come up, and fountains from the great deep were brought up, so that there was water from above the firmament and water from below the firmament coming to cover the earth. And it did cover the earth. Now, we're going to talk later about the question of whether the earth was really over the whole world or whether it was just over that region. I'll tell you in advance, I believe it covered the whole world. But there are many Christians, including evangelicals, who think, well, it wouldn't be necessary to say it covered the whole world. All that would really be necessary is to wipe out man in whatever regions man lived in. And in those early days, man hadn't spread over the whole world yet, and therefore God, it'd be sort of a bad economy to wipe out the whole world when God just wanted to punish wicked man. So why couldn't it have been just a huge flood in the region in which Noah and humanity generally lived to wipe out them and spare the rest of the world? And there are several arguments given in favor of what's called a local flood. And some people think that the wording of the passage can even be interpreted that way. We'll consider the pros and cons of that shortly. But one of the arguments is, well, there isn't enough water in the whole world to cover the earth as we know it now. I mean, how in the world could Mount Everest or the Matterhorn be conceived as being covered with water 22 and a half feet above its top? I mean, where did all that water go? Now, where is it? They say that even if you condense all the water in the atmosphere, all the vapor that's there, and bring it down, it would only cover the earth by a few feet, not hundreds of feet deep. Now, of course, this does not take into consideration something very significant, and that is that the mountains in their present heights are not original. Even geologists who are not Christians know that those mountains rose through seismic activity. Likewise, we don't know that the ocean bottom was as deep in those days as it is now. There are parts of the ocean bottom that have not yet even been discovered it's so deep. Now, consider that if the original earth before the flood, before all this seismic activity, before all this movement of the earth's plates and so forth is going on, if the oceans were relatively shallow by today's standards, I mean, some creatures can only live in oceans that are, you know, a mile deep or something like that, but still, that could be relatively shallow compared to now. And mountains were relatively lower. Then the same amount of water that now is in the deep, deep, deep oceans could have covered the earth. In other words, where the water went might be that the shape of the earth's crust was altered through the activity, the geological activity associated with the flood. Some mountains are taller now than they were then, and some ocean valleys are deeper than they were then. And you could simply say, if we brought some of the mountains down and some of the ocean bottoms up, there's no question but that the amount of water that's currently in the oceans could cover the earth and those mountains. It just depends on how far down you bring the mountains, how far up you bring the ocean bed. Once again, I'm not saying this is certainly what happened. I'm just saying there's nothing implausible about this. When people try to bring up the impossibility of a worldwide flood, they're taking for granted that they know more than they could possibly know. And I'm saying I don't know for sure that the mountains were lower before the flood or the oceans shallower, but there's certainly no reason to rule that out. And if that is a possibility, it certainly would easily account for the mystery of where all the water went. It's in the deep ocean now. Now let's go on. Verse 17. Now the flood was on the earth 40 days. This actually means that the rain kept coming down for 40 days because the waters, actually after the rain stopped, continued for longer than that. The flood was on the earth for 40 days. The waters increased during that time because the rain was coming down during that time and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. And the waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth. And the ark moved about on the surface of the waters, and the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth, and all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. That would mean that the waters prevailed 15 cubits above the top mountains. And as I said, this could have been deduced, even if no one made exact measurements, this could have been deduced by the fact that the ark's wake, the submerged portion of the ark, would have been about 22 and a half feet, since it was 45 feet tall. If it floated about approximately half submerged, then its bottom would be about 15 cubits below the water's surface, and it never hit any mountaintops. Therefore, one could deduce that the water covered the mountaintops by at least that amount that we read of in verse 20. Verse 21, and all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was in the dry land died. So he destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. That means that they did not begin to subside for that long. The waters rose for 40 days and continued without subsiding another 110 days. So a total of 150 days, the waters prevailed from the time the rain began to the time the ark actually hit something and lodged on the top of the mountain. We deduce this from what's told in the next chapter. I'm getting ahead of the data here in telling you that, but just so you make sense of these numbers. It rained for 40 days, and then for another 110 days, the ark didn't hit anything. It was assumed the water had not gone down significantly for a total of 150 days. Now, it's interesting how little sensationalism is in the story compared to how much could be. I mean, if Cecil B. DeMille or anyone, or for that matter Steven Spielberg, wanted to make a movie about Noah's Ark, you can imagine how much exploitation there'd be of the crisis of people, you know, swimming for safety until they were hit in the head by a floating log and you know, holding their babies in the water. You even see artists' renditions of the flood occasionally in Christian story Bibles, you know, depicting all the people dying, screaming and knocking on the door of the ark, saying, "Let us in," but it's too late for them, and so forth. I mean, you could really dramatize this big time. I mean, it must have been one of the most sensational events ever on Earth. But the ark or the story of it in the Bible is really so reserved. It just says everyone died, all the animals died, except those in the ark. It doesn't give any detail. It's so straightforward. It's so devoid or resistant of the temptation to sensationalize. It's simply matter of fact. This happened. Now, of course, if you could put yourself in that scene and picture the scene, it'd be a very gruesome and grotesque scene. There have been many floods in modern times. Of course, none that cover the whole earth, and there won't be any more of those, the Bible says. But there have been many floods that we have observed where, you know, just from rain runoff from mountains running down into mountain valleys where people are living, you know, cause, you know, these waves of crashing water, tearing up trees, tearing down houses, sweeping everything in its way. And that's just a local flood. But that thing happening globally and all these waters, you know, pouring in from everywhere, converging on each other, there's tremendous violence. And also there's reason to believe that, you know, because of the fountains of the great deep being broken up, there was geological and seismographic activity, volcanic activity. There's probably an actual reshaping of the earth's crust. There could have been lava flows. There could have been the earth opening up and swallowing, you know, people as at a later time through the judgment of God. We don't know. All I can say is one could easily sensationalize on this story and probably do so quite realistically without embellishing. But the story doesn't do that. It's with tremendous reserve that the story is told. It's just matter of fact. This happened, and the author didn't apparently intend to make a bestseller out of this. He just intended to tell it like it was. He resisted the temptation to make it sensational more than he did. Chapter 8 continues, "Then God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided gradually, however. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped." That had happened earlier, after 40 days. "And the rain from heaven was restrained, and the waters receded continually from the earth." But not real fast. There was no place for them to go, except, I mean, nowhere for them to run off real quickly. "At the end of 150 days, the waters decreased." Now, what this means is from the time the rain started to the 150th day, which is the 40 days of rain plus 110 days, the waters decreased to the point that the ark could actually rest on something solid. Although no one could see anything solid, there was still 22 and a half feet of water above the mountaintop, but it had subsided that much so that the ark could actually rest on something without floating freely. It says that in verse 4, "Then the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat." Remember, the flood had started on the second month, the 17th day. Now it was the seventh month, the 17th day. Same day of the month, 7 months later. Or, 5 months later, 150 days later. We're talking about here. Okay. "On the mountains of Ararat." This region today is associated with modern Turkey. At one time, I believe it was in the region of Armenia. It's controlled, I believe, by Turkey today, this region. There are people who claim to have seen the ark up there. Unfortunately, incontrovertible evidence has not been forthcoming, but there's, frankly, I'm surprised at the fascination of many Christians to want to go up and prove the ark is there. I guess that would be interesting, and I guess that would be maybe helpful to some doubters, but I don't care if they ever find the ark. I know it's there, or I know it was anyway. I don't need that kind of confirmation. If they would tear Mount Ararat apart pebble by pebble and not find any evidence of the ark, that wouldn't prove to me that the ark had never been there. It would be easy enough to imagine they might tear it apart and use the materials for building houses or something like that, and there would be no ark there today. I don't need those kind of confirmations. The Bible is true because God says it. And some people maybe are encouraged by those confirmations. I've heard many, there are several books written by people who claim they've seen the ark or that are cataloging the number of times the ark was photographed from the air or whatever. Problem is, the claim is that the ark is in a region of those mountains that is mostly frozen most of the time. and is encased in a glacier or ice, so that it's not the easiest thing to find. They say they've taken photographs from the air and seen it and so forth. But there's even one book out there that claims that the Ark's been fully excavated and they've made a national park around it, and you can go drive out there and see it. Now, if that were true, it seems like more people would have. It'd be less disputable whether the Ark was there, but yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of wild things claimed. I have no doubt the Ark was there, and I don't have any reason to doubt the Ark might not still be there. No problem. But my faith does not rest on the claims of modern books about people who claim to have seen it. And the waters decreased continually. That is, after the Ark came to rest on the mountain, the waters kept going down until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. Okay, so it was 2.5 months then from the time the Ark rested on the top of Mount Ararat till the time the waters got low enough for them to actually see. That means to go down 22.5 feet took 2.5 months. Now, that's an important consideration when we say, was this a local flood or was this a worldwide flood? Because even if it could be argued that a local flood would fit much of the data of the story, it is hard to imagine why it would be a local flood would be above the mountaintops for 2.5 months before even the mountaintops could be seen. I mean, usually, even in the most severe floods, a few days after the water supply is cut off, it all runs off. It all runs off and the ground gets dry again. It doesn't take 2.5 months for the water to go down 22.5 feet. The reason that that happened would apparently be because there is no place on earth for the water to run off to. And it had to be reabsorbed, or it had to be evaporated or whatever. I mean, it's a slow process of the water going down. It was not at the rate that one would expect in the case of a local flood, even a very severe local flood. Now, it says in verse 6, so it came to pass at the end of 40 days, that is another 40 days, that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Then he sent out a raven, which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up from the earth. He also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had abated from the face of the ground. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, and she returned to the ark to him, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and drew her into the ark to himself. And he waited yet another 7 days, and again he sent out a dove from the ark. Then the dove came to him in the evening, and behold, a freshly plucked olive leaf was in her mouth. And Noah knew that the waters had abated from the earth. So he waited yet another 7 days and sent out a dove, which did not return again to him anymore. Okay, what's this all about? Noah was, he couldn't see much. He could see probably some mountaintops, but there wouldn't have been much foliage if he could just barely see them. And he wasn't sure that the mountaintops he was seeing were the highest ones anywhere. There might be some that were much beyond the range of his vision that were much more dry than the ones he could see because they were taller. And there's no guarantee that the ark was resting on the tallest mountain around. And therefore he sent birds out to see if they could find somewhere a place to live. And initially he sent out a raven. And the raven apparently didn't need to come back. It just kind of wandered about, apparently perched at night somewhere or another. It found places it could rest. But a raven is a hardy bird compared to a dove. The dove he sent out had to come back. The dove didn't find an amenable environment first off. And so he waited another 7 days and sent out another dove. And this time the dove did find something. Found an olive branch, which she plucked off and brought in her beak. Olives grow on trees, and trees typically grow rather slowly compared to other plants. They're not like grass or something like that. And it's hard to know exactly how it is that we're to understand an olive tree had grown in the short time now that the waters had receded. However, I read a while ago about olive trees, just because I was curious about this, and found out that olive trees are known to be... You can take a shoot from an olive tree, and if it happens to lodge in the ground, it can take root and can produce fresh leaves. And apparently, there had been debris floating in the flood, including dead trees and all kinds of things, maybe trees that were not all that dead but were uprooted. And some debris of an olive tree must have lodged itself and been able to take root and produce some fresh leaves. And that was the first sign of fresh life, of new life on the new planet after the flood that Noah had seen. And therefore, it apparently gave him some comfort to see signs of new life, not just the life that had been preserved on the ark, but something growing in the new cleansed world. And then 7 days more, he sent the dove out again. It didn't come back. So he knew that a dove, which is a much more delicate bird than a raven, a dove could not necessarily live in every environment where a raven could. And the raven was able to stay away right from the beginning. But the doves, a couple weeks later, were able to do so. So he knew that the land was drying in lower areas where those conditions would not be so severe and the dove could find a place to live. Okay, verse 13. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, in the first day of the month, that the waters were dried up from the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry. And in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. Then God spoke to Noah, saying, Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, and whatever creeps on the earth, according to their families, went out of the ark. Now, if you've ever wondered exactly how long they were there on the ark, you can now calculate it. Because in chapter 7, verse 11, we were told that the rain began in the 600th year of Noah's life, second month, 17th day. Now we read in chapter 8, verse 14, that the earth was thoroughly dry, and God allowed them to leave the ark, in the 601st year of Noah's life, so this is the next year, in the second month, that's the same month of the next year, and on the 27th day. That means that a full year and 10 days had transpired since the rains began to the time the earth was dry and Noah left the ark. Because it was... If we use the names of our months, February, let's say, the second month, February 17th of 1 year, the rain started, and February 27th of the next year, the earth was dry. That means that a whole year and 10 days had passed. So even from the time that they saw the tops of the mountains in chapter 8, verse 5, it was another almost 5 months before the earth was completely dry. So, I mean, this is certainly an argument for a worldwide flood, because the going down of the water level was extremely slow. It went down just far enough to see the mountaintops from the time that the ark actually was touching with its bottom, a mountaintop, till the water went down far enough to see it. 22.5 feet was 2.5 months. And then from there it took another 5 months before the earth was dry enough to actually leave the ark. So that was very slow drying, and it suggests that there was really no place for the water just to run off too quickly like it would if it was a local flood. Now, verse 20, Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake. Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, and winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. Now, God was pleased that the first act of the emerging human family on a new earth without any other human beings on it was an act of worship. an act of consecration. Abraham did this same kind of thing when he migrated into Canaan. Wherever he camped, he built an altar to the Lord. It's as if he, sort of like when we go in on the moon, they stuck an American flag. They're saying, "This, we got here, we claim it." Kind of a, in a way, kind of an arrogant thing to do, to claim the moon for one country on earth. But actually, I don't think they were intended to say it quite like that. But, you know, they say, "We got here first, this is our banner." And God, when God's people claim territory for God or consecrated territory for God, they build an altar, sort of like planting God's flag there and offered sacrifices there. Abram did this continually throughout the promised land. Noah did that as soon as he came off the ark to claim the earth for God, as it were, and to acknowledge God and to acknowledge himself as a worshiper of God. And that's a good start for the beginning of a new human race and a new world. God was pleased by it, and he actually said he would never again, he said, "I will never again curse the ground for man's sake." Now, this cannot mean that he was now removing the curse that had come on the ground when Adam and Eve sinned. Remember, he said that the ground would be cursed, and thorns and thistles. He's not saying he's removing that curse. He's referring to specifically the curse that had just finished, the flood. There won't be another flood like that one. And he specifies that, of course, later on in more detail, that he'll never send another flood of that type again. That is made clear in chapter 9, in verse 11. "Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth." That's the curse that is on the earth that he said he's not going to do again. It's not that he's removing that curse that came on the earth through Adam's sin, but rather the particular kind of curse that has just passed will not be repeated. And he says, "Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth." Now, you might remember back in chapter 6, the reason that God sent the flood in the first place. In verse 5 of chapter 6 says it's because he saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Now he acknowledges after the flood that man's still that way. Even now, these people who, nonetheless, even though they're worshiping God, they're still fallen people. They still have corruption in their hearts. He knows there will be sin again. God knows this is not the end of evil. Man is still evil, but God is nonetheless not ever going to do the same thing he just did. Apparently, since judgment is an activity that God does not enjoy, he only does when he has to, he probably did not enjoy seeing the deaths of all those people and animals in the flood, and he just resolved, "I'm not going to do that again." That doesn't mean he's acknowledging he did the wrong thing. He just figured once is enough. I'm not going to go through that again. I'm not going to put the world through that again. Even though man is still corrupt, I'm still not going to do that anymore. Now, there is a little poem there in verse 22 that has to do with part of the pledge that God made to man after the flood. And that is, in verse 22, "While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, day and night shall not cease." That apparently means that this cycle of the agricultural year and each day is going to be regular until the end of the world. One thing that is possibly significant is that this is the first time in the Bible that mentions the four seasons. Seed time and harvest would be fall and summer, probably. Cold and heat would be winter and summer or spring. There's a lot of repetition here because it's poetry. But the point is there are mention of the specific seasons here, and there's no mention prior to this of the seasons. Now, someone might say, didn't it say back in Genesis chapter 1 that God made the stars and the sun and the moon for signs and for seasons and for days and years? That's Genesis 1:14. But seasons there, in all likelihood, means seasons in the sense of periods of time generally. The measurement, the sun and the moon and the stars are there for the measurement of periods of time. When the Bible says that Moses chose not to follow the pleasures of sin for a season, it doesn't mean 3 months. A season simply means a period of time. When it says that after tempting Jesus for 40 days in the wilderness, the devil left him for a season, that doesn't mean for 3 months. That means just for a period of time, undesignated. God made the sun, moon, and stars to help measure times and seasons. But as far as what we call the four seasons, We don't have reference to them being around until here, until this time. It has been suggested as a possibility that the seasons actually came into existence at this time. That we have seasons now because of the tilt of the earth on its axis. If the earth was perpendicular on its axis, there would be not four seasons. There would be continuous sameness all year round. It is the actual tilt on the axis and the way that impacts different parts of the world as the earth goes around the sun in a year's time that causes the passage of seasons. I mean, everyone knows this, I think. But if the earth was vertical or perpendicular on its axis, there would be no seasons. And some have felt like the tilt of the earth on its axis occurred during the flood, and that there were therefore not the various seasons that we know prior to the flood, and that this is a change, a new situation. There's going to be cold and heat, winter and summer, seed time and harvest, different seasons. That is maybe reading more into it than we need to into this statement, but it is part of the whole fabric of a certain scenario that some people think is realistic about the flood. Now, I want to talk very briefly about the arguments for and against a total global flood. Those who say the flood was not global, but just local, they do so partly on the basis, as I say, that they don't think there's enough water around to cover the whole earth. But as I said, that can be accounted for by increased depth of riverbeds, ocean beds, and increased height of mountains after the flood because of the changes in the earth's crust that took place there. It is also argued that certain civilizations like the American Indians and the Chinese have ancient king lists and legends and historical memories that go back 10,000 years, long before the time of the flood. And these histories could not be continuous if there had been a flood that affected their lands. And therefore, it argues that the flood didn't affect China, for example, didn't affect America, where the Indians were. It only affected the Middle East, where Noah was, and so forth. However, no one can be sure that either the Indian or the Chinese legends are historically accurate. These are not written histories, and they therefore are passed by word of mouth, and it's very possible that the time reported of the lengths of the reigns of their kings and chiefs and so forth is not as reliable as the Bible is in terms of its historical accuracy. Some people think that the presence of various races of men on the earth suggests that there must have been races, different races from the beginning, and we couldn't have all come from Noah's family. So there must have been some people on the earth who weren't wiped out. But I've said before, there's nothing genetically impossible about all the races coming from one family, whether it was Adam and Eve or whether it was Noah's family. It doesn't make any difference. It is known that all humans probably came from a common couple anyway, somewhere back there. One of the things that has made people wonder whether it could have been really true that all the animals went on the ark is that since the time of the flood, animals are distributed on different continents. And people say, well, how could the kangaroos have gotten from Australia to Noah's ark? But, of course, this supposes that the continents as we have them distributed now were always that way. As I said earlier, it's possible there was one continent in those days, and that all the animals since were distributed to those areas even before the continents drifted and became isolated by the drifting of continents. There's at least that possibility that there's simply no argument that is compelling that requires a local flood. First of all, if it was only a local flood, why would Noah even have to build an ark? He had 120 years to prepare. Why didn't he just leave that valley? If that was just going to be that valley to be flooded, why would God even have him build an ark? What a lot of waste of effort. Just get out of town. Just leave the area. The reason that God had him involve himself for those 120 years building an ark instead of migrating somewhere else is because there was no place safe to migrate to. The flood was going to be global. The size of the ark and therefore the capacity of animals that were going to be needed suggests that he really did have to take the animals of every kind. And that means there'd be no place for animals in the world to be safe because the flood was universal. When it says all the mountains were covered 22 and a half feet above their tops, how could you contain a flood in a local area when the water was higher than the mountains? The Bible affirms that all flesh died on the earth. The flood lasted a year, and took a very long time to subside. I've already pointed out that that's an evidence of a universal flood. And one other thing I would like to suggest, and that is that God said he would never send another flood like this again. If this was only a local flood, then God hasn't kept his promise, because there have been many local floods since the days of Noah. What there has not been is a worldwide flood, but there have been many devastating local floods. Therefore, to call this an unprecedented, once in a unique time in history thing and never to be repeated, God wouldn't be trustworthy in saying that if he was talking about a local flood, because those have been repeated. I think all the evidence really points to a universal flood, a universal judgment, and this actually serves as a type and a shadow of the universal judgment at the coming of Christ. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 20 and 21, talk about the flood as a picture and a type of the eventual destruction of the world by fire at the coming of Christ, and it's a universal judgment as well. Thus, God has once shown that he is capable and willing, if necessary, to judge the whole world in doing so in the flood. And he declares that he will do so again, not with water, but with fire. At the coming of Christ, the world can expect a universal judgment. Well, we run out of time at this point, and therefore we close our study of these chapters. We'll come back to chapter 9 next time and carry on our story of Noah and of his descendants after that.